send your comments to app@kpft.org. Once applied, the KPFT app will have you applauding the ease of listening, donating, and keeping up with KPFT. One thing is apparent, here is a new way to listen to KPFT on any smartphone, Android, or Apple. KPFT Houston, the appropriate destination for your ears.
Hi, I'm Dwayne Bradley, and you might know me from Open Journal, Monday evenings at 6 p.m. Thanks for listening to KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT in Houston, the program's Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. And our special guest today is Paul Loeb, and he has a new article. It's Owners Against Elon, Why Boycott Matters More Than Ever. And we're going to go to our commentary by Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back with Paul.
Look out, the corporate cat is out of the bag. This particular cat is the fast-metastasizing software technology called artificial intelligence. A cadre of multibillion-dollar high-tech giants have surreptitiously been advancing AI for a couple of decades, literally creating a new autonomous species of thinking beings. These are computer-powered humanoid bots, increasingly able to do the intellectual, creative, managerial, and other complex jobs that millions of human beings now do. The billionaire pushers of this brave new bot economy know that this amounts to placing a neutron bomb in the American workplace, so they have intentionally lied about its job-obliterating impact. However, after years of hush-hush development, the AI technology is now so advanced and the corporate investment in it is so gargantuan that the perpetrators no longer care what the public thinks. This year, Amazon, Google, Meta, Microsoft, Oracle, and other Silicon Valley oligarchs have been feverishly dumping hundreds of billions of dollars each into a global corporate gold rush to supplant humans with AI bots in practically every economic sector. They expect to automate half of all entry-level white-collar jobs within 5 years. And one Silicon Valley outfit, bluntly named Mechanize, calculates that its plan to, quote, fully automate work can be achieved within 30 years. Indeed, BotWorld is now using today's AI technology to create superintelligent systems that can outthink humans. Yes, bots themselves are working to produce more powerful bots to speed up AI's bot takeover of work. This is Jim Hightower saying, to make it worse, Congress recently imposed a 10-year ban on any state laws attempting to regulate AI. Just unleash the bots and see what happens. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
Welcome to the Progressive Forum. I'm Susan Phillips, here with Wally James, and in this special edition, we'll be interviewing activist and journalist Paul Loeb and talk with him about his latest piece entitled Holding Musk Accountable, Here's How We Supercharge the Tesla Boycott. We'll also hear later in the show from Heather Cox Richardson and then Larry Krizan with the news. Paul Rogat Loeb is an American writer and activist whose career has focused on civic engagement and social change. He's authored several books. I'll mention two of the latest here from 2010, Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times, and from 2014, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, The Citizen's Guide to a Hope in a Time of Fear. Paul's articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and Huffington Post, Mother Jones, and The Nation, just to name a few, as well as being interviewed on such platforms as NBC, CNN, PBS, Fox, C-SPAN, National Public Radio, and the BBC ABC, NBC, and CBS radio networks. He founded the Campus Election Engagement Project, a national partisan, nonpartisan effort to engage students in voting, engaging some 600 campuses by 2020, and he founded he also founded Guides.Vote, which created nonpartisan candidate guides for major elections. And we are so pleased to be able to speak with him this evening. Paul Loeb, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Hey, good to be here.
Paul, it's great to have you. Haven't had you on in a while. I'm glad you can make time for us.
Oh, really, anytime.
All right. Well, I hadn't really been giving a lot of thought to Elon Musk and what he's up to. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We've basically got a situation where the world's richest man is trying now to become even richer, by a amount that it's really hard for ordinary mortals like us to comprehend. And I started, when I read about the sort of $1 billion payday.
One moment, really quick. Paul, could you please take your phone off speaker and speak a little clearly more into your phone for us tonight?
Yeah, is it better?
Not better.
Well,
that's our producer, Blue.
Yeah.
So sorry. We've got gremlins
okay,
in the microphone.
Does that work?
Just say it again.
The echo stopped.
That sounds a bit better.
A little bit better,
yeah. Yeah, okay, let's go with that.
Perfect.
Finish with what you were saying.
Should I continue on it, or should I call in on a different phone that won't echo?
Do you have another phone that might be better?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll do that right now.
Yeah, we can chat about your article while you're calling back in. Does that sound good?
Call in right now.
All right.
Perfect.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. So I'm just was thinking I could read a little bit from this article while
sure.
he's calling back.
That would be good.
This is a quotation from the start of his interview, or that is to say his article calling Holding Musk Accountable. He says, I've been struggling to imagine Elon Musk, what he might do if he gets his $1 trillion payday. He could spend $1 million a day for 3,000 years.
Oh, man.
Or, more realistically, $100 million a day for 30 years. Or he could spend the $290 million he invested in Trump's election and do it 3,400 times.
Mm.
Yes, whenever and whenever he pleases. Or he could buy more media properties, spending up to 20 times the $44 billion it took for him to buy Twitter and make it into misinformation swamp key to Trump's reelection. It blows your mind about
it does.
How much money that actually is.
Well, and there are so many people in this country that are just scraping to get by, and you have this super wealthy person, just... It doesn't make any sense. It is so unfair the way things are set up.
Right. I mean, and yet they're reducing or they're getting rid of the SNAP. I can't remember the exact name of the program, but it amounts to a little bit more than $6 a day for food insecure people.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's let's just say it's not fair. But the money the Tesla board has just handed Musk is not guaranteed. He has to meet goals like delivering 20 million Tesla vehicles and dramatically increasing Tesla's stock price. Ordinary citizens can prevent that, but we need to take our efforts to another level. And I think he's back. Paul is back to talk about that next level. Hello, Paul. We got you.
Yeah, you do. And sorry about those technical difficulties.
Oh, wow. That is like night and day.
Much better. Thank you for doing that.
And, you know, ever since COVID and the lockdown, when everyone did begin to have to rely on Zoom and such platforms as that, we're all now kind of expecting, you know, gremlins in our communication systems here and there. Appreciate your working with us there.
So tell us why you decided to write this article.
Well, so I've been thinking about Tesla boycott, actually, honestly, since last summer. And I was just, when Musk started to, put money into it. But I was working on a nonpartisan project, and I was just like, I'm not writing anything because I don't want to jeopardize the project in any way. So I just like, all right, I hope somebody else comes up with that idea. And so then when come, you know, the election, and people started fairly soon afterwards, started organizing against Tesla, because, you know, here's Musk, who essentially put this just staggering sum in, but also having just bought Twitter, turned that into essentially a house political organ in many ways, that it just seemed like, okay, this is a point of leverage. And I think that people were looking around for something to do, and that boycott really got people's imagination, because it was something they could do, and they could do it in their own communities, and they could push back on that sort of conjunction of forces that brought our country to what many of us feel is a fairly disastrous state. And so I was looking at that boycott and just being really encouraged. And it clearly was and is having a tangible impact. I mean, we're talking about, you know, huge drops in sales in Europe, which is copying our example, drops in sales in the U.S., even though EV sales were climbing, drops in the stock, although it's since rebounded. I mean, major, major impact. And so no question, I mean, like the much-vaunted Cybertruck has literally sold just 16,000 units, which is enormously low, and that's with Musk buying a bunch of them from his other companies. So it's had an impact, but one of the things that struck me is that they needed to do one other thing. And let me loop around for a moment and just sort of, when I've been thinking about Musk now, which is, how do you spend $1 trillion if you got it? Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get your mind around, because it's a staggering amount of money. I thought, okay, he could spend $1 million a day for 3,000 years if he lived that long. You know, maybe AI will embody his ghost into some kind of technology, you know, or $100 million a day for 30 years. Or he could do I did the math.
He could take the
$290 million in Trump election. He could do it 3,400 times, which means he could do it globally in every election, pretty much everywhere.
It is
that's
insane.
A really bad outcome.
Yeah, it's insane how much that is.
It's
so
insane.
And you were talking about
buy Twitter 20 times over. You know.
Yeah, exactly. And you were going over some of the math about how it was affecting his bottom line. Let's see, did you say European Tesla sales dropped nearly 40% in a year?
Yep, nearly 40%. U.S. dropped 19%, even though they lowered their prices and margins. And, you know, EV sales were increasing overall. Tesla's U.S. share hit an eight-year low. I mean, it's a lot of negative things for Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the rule in politics is if you have a institution you're taking on and you're actually having an impact, they're rarely going to say, oh, you're having an impact.
Mm-hmm.
You do it some more.
Well, think about with Jimmy Kimmel and Disney Plus when that was an immediate impact. And we got
that was an immediate impact.
Fairly.
Yeah.
What do you do, though, when...
And even there, I should say that they said, oh, we're just bringing him back. This doesn't have anything to do with the boycott.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, how do you keep a sustained effort in a boycott campaign when it's a longer term? I think eventually people just get over it and they go back. For instance, Amazon, Target, Home Depot, those were three big targets for boycotts. But there are so many people who depend, especially on Amazon Prime and by association now Whole Foods. And it really is difficult for people to keep that up in a sustained way if they're not seeing a result.
Yeah, I think that's true. And one of the ways that I think you keep something going is you keep coming up with new approaches. Mm-hmm. And one of the areas that to me, that I mean, I don't want to in it sort of criticize the campaign that's been really impactful, and but I think they've made one sort of mistake that's easy to remedy, which is the first action is don't buy a new Tesla. Mm-hmm. And we all agree that it's like, you know, if you stop buying a new Tesla and enough people do, then even with all the dreams about Musk being the genius, so never mind the relationship between actual earnings and the skyrocketing process of the stock, that it will have an impact. It will, you know, it'll hit the drop the prices as it did, and he'll have less money. And certainly within the, because I look through the kind of contracts, not quite the word, what the board agreed to give him and what he had to do it. And if the stock doesn't go up, he doesn't get that extra money. Mm-hmm. And if the stock goes down, his current assets become less. And that's enormously important because we just don't want him to have more clout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we thought we were sort of, he had dropped out of, he'd sort of separated, parted ways with the Trump administration and Doge has been ended. But he was, as you were writing in your essay, just hanging out at the White House for when the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman was in town. And I like what you added, though you weren't sure if they offered him a bone saw, but he's still promoting.
Yeah, everyone gets their own bone saw to cut up the meat.
Right. but he's continued promoting ultra-right-wing parties, you say, globally, like the German Alternative for Deutschland.
Alternative Deutschland, yeah. And I think people, in that sort of break with Trump, that people sort of thought, oh, well, okay, he's out of politics now. This isn't as urgent. We don't have to think about Musk. But it's clear, and who knows what the relationship between those two egomaniacs is going to go. But it's clear to me that he's not withdrawn as a force in the world. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy to have him go off to his own private island or whatever and do his thing and not be involved in anything. But that's not the way it's working. Is he's continuing to have an impact. He, you know, came up with this Brockopedia to try and replace Wikipedia, mm-hmm. which was essentially, if you searched like white supremacists, it said all sorts of nice things about it. And French Grok promotes Holocaust denial. I mean, it's really obscene.
Yeah, even if he doesn't, even if he sort of sinks out of public view for the most part, I mean, he's still a kind of a Bond villain, isn't he? He's going to be.
He really is. I mean, I guess they didn't, you know, Ian Fleming wasn't around
right.
to write more novels, but in some ways he already had.
Yeah.
And he's got Starlink as well, which, you know, I think and he's in charge of a lot of communication around the globe.
Yeah, no, it does. And that power is disturbing. I mean, he did offer it to Ukraine at the beginning, which was a good thing, but then they actually had an attack ready on Crimea, which at that point probably had a decent chance of success. And that suddenly Musk said, okay, I'm going to geofence this, and you can't attack Crimea and take back that territory. And so just the idea that a single person who doesn't live in that country, doesn't have any existing ties, could essentially help determine the fate of a country by saying, oh, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an enormously disturbing amount of power.
You said something about changing it up when we were talking about that people can become discouraged over long-term boycott campaigns.
Yeah.
That they don't.
So this is the change, and let me sort of lay it out. That initially in the campaign, the first idea, which is absolutely has to continue, is don't buy new Teslas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there are 2 million people out there who have Teslas. Like, literally, as we are talking, my next-door neighbor, who is a really good person, who put solar panels on her roof after I put solar panels on my roof, bought the Tesla because she bought the low-end Tesla because she wanted to not have a gas car. I mean, great person. And she has a Tesla. So the question is, what do you do about that? And the campaign has been saying, sell your Teslas. Like, so, and that'll put more used Teslas on the market, and then that'll drive the competition, and less new ones will sell. And maybe that's true, but if you're going to sell a Tesla, and if you want to drive an EV because you recognize that climate change is real, and you don't want to be driving a gasoline car, and you sell that Tesla and you buy another EV, you're probably going to take a $5,000 to $10,000 hit, and that's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, it's not possible just to up and do things like that. You mentioned, like, bumper stickers or decals.
Well, exactly, and I don't know if you've had this response, but when I see a Tesla driving, sometimes I just think, oh, God, there's so many of them on the road, and all of them paid for Elon Musk, and they didn't know he was going to go the route he did. It's not their fault. But if somebody else is looking at them from outside, they're just, you know, watching the cars, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I think I'll get an EV. I know of Tesla, it's the biggest brand, on and on and on. However, when you see a Tesla and it says a bumper sticker, I bought this before Elon Musk went crazy.
Right.
That's a very different message. Mm-hmm. I'm here for the climate, not Elon.
Maybe
anti-Elon Tesla Club.
Maybe there needs to be a contest.
Buy new Tesla. And you look at that, and what you see is, here is somebody who is saying, for good reasons, for honorable reasons, I made a decision to buy this car before Elon went crazy, mm-hmm. and I don't recommend that you buy this car. In fact, please don't. It just sends a totally different message.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something, you know, in terms of responding, again, there's 2 million people out there. Right now, you see a Tesla without a sticker, and it's still an ambassador for the brand. If you see a Tesla with the sticker, it's an ambassador against the brand. And I think that makes a huge difference. And so what people can do, and this is something I'm, you know, hoping the campaign does, is make it easy. You know, maybe do a sample email or letter or, you know, you can print out my article or something like that, and, you know, talk to their friend who has a Tesla and just say, hey, you know, I'm not saying you're a bad person. I mean, I couldn't afford a Tesla, but at the point that Elon Musk bought SolarCity, which is the biggest solar installer in the country, and they were in financial trouble, I took $10,000 in my retirement, have to put in something. I put it into a Tesla SolarCity bond because I thought they were doing good things, which at that point they in most ways were. But now it's like, okay, I wish I hadn't. I wish millions of others hadn't. And, you know, you can't rerun history, but you can look at where that point is that people can have an impact. And I think if you offer, I mean, people can buy them for their neighbors. And, you know, somebody's like, okay, well, my workplace, I'm really going to get in trouble. Then you get a magnet or a decal you pull on and off, and that works just as well.
Right. And I was going to suggest a second ago here that, you know, maybe a campaign could be made about coming up with clever slogans for these decals or bumper stickers.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's some great ones out there. My favorite, I can't say on the radio, uh-huh. So, but there's some scathing and scatological ones. But it's a challenge for everybody.
I think that, you know, people need to, you know, understand the damage that's going on here. And
yeah.
Also, just the power that the super rich have that can affect you know, our everyday lives. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about it. I mean, go back to the Doge period. And Elon Musk sends a bunch of, you know, some of them 21-year-olds or whatever. I mean, just sends a bunch of people that just kind of, well, they've done the wrecking ball to the East Wing of the White House. He's just to go through and just discard things without ever, I mean, there was no way that people with the best motives in the world and the most thoughtful people could go in and say, okay, you've got whatever it was, you know, four weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and you can basically look at what needs to be eliminated. Mm-hmm. But some of the things they did, I mean, have huge consequences. I mean, I think it was, you know, if I looked at the USAID cut, I mean, they were, what was it? I think 400, there was the estimate of like 400,000 people died so far,
yeah.
Mostly children.
Yeah, 400,000 children and 200,000 adults approximately.
Right. I mean, that's, so if I take, I mean, I see what is Seattle. Seattle's smaller than Houston. But if I take my city of Seattle, it means that probably 90% of the population of Seattle is dead. Mm. I mean, that's one way to visualize it. And it's staggering. And this is because on some level of the decisions of one enormously wealthy, rich individual. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know what greater a sort of impact one can think of, but it's just, you know, it's gigantic.
Right. And it's tricky, isn't it? Because when you have an entrepreneur who has his finger in so many different pies, it's like whack-a-mole. I mean, there are
right.
relationships that you aren't even aware of. That, I mean, you can hit one, you can boycott one aspect, but there's going to be something else, you know, that it's very difficult to separate, to focus on one thing. But the cars, of course, on the road are pretty much in your face.
Right. And I wish that I could think of a great campaign that would be hurting SpaceX, but it's tough. Because it's basically contracting with the government, and the government is the buddy he brought into office. It is possible, and people are in the campaign. It's Tesla takedown. They're beginning to do things like you have a city. The city does fleet or company. The city or the company do fleet orders. Don't order Teslas. You could pressure a rental car company with fleet orders. There are institutions that purchase Starlink. Don't use Starlink, which is hard, admittedly, because they've got an almost a monopoly. You can develop alternatives to Tesla charging stations. And, you know, I mean, I have a Chevy Bolt EV. We don't use a Tesla charging station. There are other ones around. So, you know, it's all the some, I guess, of what I would call the individual efforts, but also the common efforts, that it's not as if you can instantly wipe out the resources of somebody who's worth, I don't know what he is today, you know, $400 billion or something like that. But you start chipping away at it, and some of this stuff is leveraged, which means it cascades if you start having stop drops. And suddenly he's got less power, and suddenly he's got to deal with the threats on his power instead of thinking, oh, what do I want to do to mess up the world today?
Mm-hmm.
Or to assert my... I don't think he thinks of it as messing up the world. I think he thinks of it as assert my rightful dominance over these stupid humans who are my inferiors.
What about some of his fellow billion almost trillionaires like Bezos or Zuckerberg? How do we, I mean, do you have a focus on them as well, or are we focusing right now on Musk at this point?
Well, it's hard. You know, one of certainly a lesson from the labor movement in its periods of great successes is you don't always take everybody on at once.
Mm-hmm.
You can go after some person, you know, some institute, one of the companies, then later you'll go after another one of them, and you kind of play them off against each other. It's certainly difficult, given the power that they have. I mean, I would argue that Amazon is potentially the most vulnerable, but also one of the ones people are the most wedded to, because it's sort of, somebody who wrote a book on them called The Everything Store, and it's the everything store.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I actually almost never buy from Amazon. It's doable, but it's less convenient. You have to go to a bunch of other places.
Right, it's and your one
I
stop.
Guess when people are talking about the impact of Jeff Bezos on the Washington Post, which, in my view, he was the guy who, it was team won the award for the investigation of the priest pedophilia stuff at the Boston Globe. There was that movie called Spotlight, Marty Baron. Mm-hmm. And when Marty Baron was running in Trump one term, the Washington Post, in my view, was the best newspaper in the country, of U.S. newspapers, not Canada, not The Guardian. And it was amazing. And then Bezos, who owned it, this time just decides, well, I better be more conciliatory. And he guts the editorial page, not just guts the editorial department. I mean, he literally says it's going to only be people who push free market stuff. And there's been, I can't even remember how many articles praising Bezos. And they also chased away, you know, some good news people. But the challenge there is that they, as a political writer, I'm sitting here with my Washington Post digital subscription ready to renew at the end of the year and debating whether or not to keep it. But if you, in fact, take the Post down, then some really good journalists who do good work exposing what's going on will lose their jobs. On the other hand, if you do damage to Amazon, if you do damage to Amazon, you actually do damage to my city of Seattle, but the trade-off's still worth it.
Yeah, I mean, and who's to say that the alternative is going to be any better, too? There are so many different things to balance.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And, so I would, in a boycott, I would much rather have people boycotting Amazon than, at least for now, boycotting the Washington Post, because there are things that we learn from their reporters that are really still really very valuable and wouldn't come out otherwise, probably.
It's difficult because I've had conversations with people fairly close to me who where I would like to boycott Amazon, and the response is, oh, but then I would miss the Beatles anthology. Which is coming out.
Yeah, there's that too.
Right? So, and surely there's another way. But
yeah, and it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard doing the right thing.
Yeah, it is. And, none of us are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
All of us have our contradictory elements. And I think that the challenge, it's not really about living a pure life, but it is about finding some ways to have an impact and push back the noxious, destructive forces of our time that are, at this point, going after democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you said it right there, going after...
And I should add that in the case of the EVs, the electric vehicles,
mm-hmm.
it's actually isn't that hard a choice. Because when Tesla started, there weren't a lot out. We bought a used Nissan Leaf that had a range of 85 miles, and that gradually dropped. but there weren't a lot of ones you could actually just drive and not worry about stuff. At this point, there's 50 or 60. So you actually can buy a car that doesn't use gas, and there's plenty of alternatives. The Beatles anthology on Amazon is not prime, is a harder case.
That is really difficult.
Paul, we've got about 5 minutes left. I want to make sure that you have time to talk about some of the things that you see happening right now. That let me just get back to this whole thing that we have these super rich people that are affecting our lives and have really no control over it, and they're the ones that are funding people like Trump. Can you say something about that?
Well, I mean, their power is real. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sort of sugarcoat it, but I would also say that their power, like oligarchs throughout history, is not unlimited. And, I mean, I'm working on a new edition of my political hope anthology called The Impossible Take a Little While. There's actually I literally reached out to Heather Cox Richardson, your next guest, on a wonderful piece of hers I'd like to include in the Civil War, on the sort of how anti-slavery opinion turned in pre-Civil War period. And what you have to recognize is that it's not guaranteed. Success isn't guaranteed. But that time and time again, people have managed to buck the odds,
yeah,
have managed to buck wealth, sound wealth, unaccountable power, and win. And if we don't try, it won't happen. I mean, I would also add that you know, compared to, say, February, March, the momentum seems to have started shifting, in part because of everything everybody's done, as well as Trump's sort of arrogant overreach and just complete contempt for reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before that we haven't addressed before we let you go?
I don't think so. I mean, the main thing is to find ways to act, and then to make the tent you're trying to build, for lack of a better metaphor, as large as possible. And that was really the crux of my thoughts on the Tesla campaign, is that they were kind of very powerful, but also in the response to existing Tesla owners limiting themselves a little bit.
Yeah, bring them under the tent, right.
Bring them into the tent. They should be part, because these, again, I've got 1, 2, 3. I live on a middle class block in Seattle, and we have 4 Teslas, either 3 or 4. And none of them are the high end model. They're all the lower end model. I think one of them was bought used. And the people who drive them are really good people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I want them on our team.
My brother and sister in law in London have a Tesla, not the truck, obviously, but.
Right.
And they bought it before the White House administration, before he went crazy, as you say.
Before he went crazy. That's
right.
The best summary.
And they're
and
they're embarrassed.
Yeah. I think most are. And so how do you help people turn that into something constructive, which is, at the very least, I'm going to stick a sticker or a magnet on the back of the car that says, I do not identify with what Elon is doing, and I invite you to be part of that rejection of his path as well. I think that can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we really appreciate you taking this time to be with us this evening. It's been great to have you on the show.
It always is.
You want to leave us with a quick thought before we let you go?
Just that these are tough times, maybe harder than most of us have ever lived through. And yet, I think that the cumulative actions of what everybody is doing, that they're mattering, they're worth doing, even if it looked like they weren't making an impact. But I actually think they are, And we just have to figure out those creative ways to push back. And, you know, it's hard in a state like Texas, but it's also maybe commensurately even more important.
Some of the titles of your books that I mentioned at the beginning in your intro, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times, or A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. I mean, this seems to be what your message is, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, and so if people want to check Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible Will Take a Little While, those are the ones that, I mean, they sold about 300,000 copies between them. And, you know, a lot of people, they kept people going. You know, they kept them from jumping off bridges, which is a good thing.
Yeah, talking off the ledge. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure.
All right. That was Paul Loeb, and been talking about his latest article. And thank you for taking that time. All right.
I think it's time for Heather Cox Richardson now.
I think so,
Letters from an American.
All right.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. Up next, it's Letters from an American with Heather Cox Richardson.
December 3rd, 2025. Republican Matt Van Epps won yesterday's special election in Tennessee's 7th Congressional District, but Republicans aren't celebrating triumphantly. Van Epps beat out Democrat Afton Bain by about 9 points in a district Donald Trump and Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn each won in 2024 by 22 points. Yesterday's vote shows a 13-point shift toward the Democrats in about a year. Aaron Pelish and Meredith Lee Hill of Politico reported the comment of a House Republican after officials called the election. Tonight is a sign that 2026 is going to be a bitch of an election cycle. Republicans can survive if we play team and the Trump administration officials play smart. Neither is certain. As G. Elliott Morris of Strength in Numbers noted, the fact that a rural Tennessee district ended up just a high single digits win for Republicans should be a 5-alarm fire for the party ahead of the 2026 midterms. Morris explains that congressional special elections have swung 17 points on average toward the Democrats, while special elections for seats in state legislatures have swung toward the Democrats by about 11 points. Morris combines these results with turnout differences in special, midterm, and presidential elections to estimate that, as of right now, the 2026 midterms can be expected to see a swing of 7 to 8 points toward the Democrats. These numbers would give Democrats control of the House of Representatives and put the Senate into play as well. It is safe to assume, Morris says, that something big has shifted in the national environment. He adds that the Republican Party will likely find itself defending an unusually wide array of seats next year, even in districts previously thought to be immune to national swings. Democrats and many Republicans think that shift has come about in large part over the issue of affordability, the rising costs of food, housing, energy, gasoline, and health care that are squeezing most Americans. Trump insisted yesterday that affordability doesn't mean anything to anybody, but most Americans would disagree. According to Morris of Strength in Numbers, the word affordability appears to mean not just the pressure of higher prices, but also frustration at economic stagnation, the unfair way in which the economic system operates, the idea of being stuck and unable to rise, the current elusiveness of the American dream. After the voters rejected Republican candidates in the early November elections, Republicans vowed they would address affordability issues. Trump initially moved in that direction, but now is rejecting the idea that his economic policies have caused hardship. Although news dropped today from Automatic Data Processing, or ADP, a private human resources management company, that the U.S. lost about 32,000 jobs last month. The losses were primarily in small businesses, which are often considered a bellwether for the rest of the economy. The Secretary of Commerce, billionaire Howard Lutnick, admitted to CNBC that Trump's policies have caused disruption, but promised they would start to build the economy in 2026. Remember, he said, as you deport people, that's going to suppress private job numbers of small businesses. But they'll rebalance and they'll regrow. So I think this is just a near-term event, and you'll see as the numbers come through over the next couple of months, you'll see that all pass, and next year the numbers are going to be fantastic. On the table more immediately are the rising costs of health insurance premiums. The Republicans' budget reconciliation bill of July extended tax cuts for the wealthy and for corporations, but neglected to extend the premium tax credits that supported the purchase of health care insurance on the Affordable Care Act insurance markets. The loss of those credits will throw at least 2 million people off health care insurance, while driving up health care costs for millions more. This will undermine the Affordable Care Act, a goal many Republicans have held since the measure became law about 15 years ago. But in September, close to 80% of Americans wanted the credits extended. As the issue became politicized, some Republicans withdrew their support, so the number dropped to about 75%. In October, Senate Democrats refused to agree to vote in favor of a continuing resolution to fund the government unless the Republicans extended that premium tax credit. But after weeks of party members calling attention to the issue, 7 Democrats and 1 independent voted in November to end the shutdown in exchange for a Senate vote on a measure to extend the tax credits. That bill is now coming due, trapping Republicans between their ideology, which calls for slashing all government programs, and voters, who overwhelmingly want the credits extended. Trump said he was going to produce a health care plan that would extend the premium tax credit for 2 years, along with new restrictions on who could use the credits, by last Monday, but postponed the announcement after Republican lawmakers demanded the extension include a nationwide abortion ban. The White House has not indicated when a new plan might appear. On Air Force One, Trump told reporters he doesn't actually want to extend the tax credits. "I'd rather not extend them at all," he said. "It may be some kind of an extension may be necessary to get something else done, because the Unaffordable Care Act has been a disaster." Kaya Hubbard of CBS News notes that any plan Senate Democrats come up with will need the support of 13 Republicans to pass the 60-vote Senate filibuster threshold. So far, though, Republican senators seem inclined not to extend the credits as they currently exist, but to try to force through a partisan measure that Democrats will not support. Republican senators are proposing different options, but say there is no point in figuring out their own position until Trump tells them what he is willing to sign. In the House, Republicans in safe districts don't want to extend the credits, saying that an end to support for the system will make it easier to kill the law they insist is a disaster. According to Alice Miranda Olstein and Robert King of Politico, some Republican strategists think that voters won't care about health care costs by the time of the midterm elections, especially if Republican policies bring down the costs of housing, energy, food, and gas. They think voters will be angrier at support for the Affordable Care Act than at higher health care costs. Vulnerable Republicans disagree. They are calling for a temporary extension of the credits to help lower costs again before the midterms. Meanwhile, House Democrats have announced they have 214 signatures on a discharge petition to force a vote on extending the tax credits and invited Republicans to join them to bring the measure to the floor. Today, Democratic Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar, a Democrat of California, told reporters, "Republicans have said that they want an extension, that they support the Affordable Care Act tax credits. We're giving them an opportunity to do that. That's what this discharge petition is about." As Leader Hakeem Jeffries has said for months, "Democrats will go anywhere and have any discussion with our Republican colleagues about addressing the Affordable Care Act tax credits or the affordability crisis. If Republicans want to have a conversation about solutions, we're all ears." The declining fortunes of MAGA Republicans are widening the rifts in the party. Annie Carney of the New York Times reported today on House Republicans' anger at Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican of Louisiana, who has defended the priorities of President Donald J. Trump at the expense of the interests of Republican lawmakers. Johnson's letting Trump call the shots means the House has accomplished very little, apart from passing the budget reconciliation bill Republicans call the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, a law the American people appear to hate. Although Republicans hold the majority in the House, Johnson has kept the members subservient to Trump's demands. He kept them out of session for almost 8 weeks during the government shutdown, for example, to try to jam the Senate into either accepting the House version of a continuing resolution to fund the government or ending the filibuster to enable Trump to force through his unpopular policies. Now, angry that they will have to run in 2026 with little to show for their House majority, House members are talking to the media about their frustration with Johnson. The Republicans have other concerns as well. Today, House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan, a Republican of Ohio, subpoenaed former special counsel Jack Smith to testify in private, rejecting Smith's offer to testify in public. Smith wanted to testify in public to prevent committee members from leaking his comments selectively to the press, spinning them to mislead Trump loyalists. But public testimony could expose some of the evidence Smith gathered about President Trump's participation in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and retention of classified documents. In a statement, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat of Maryland, the top-ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, asked, "What are our colleagues so afraid of that they won't let the American people hear directly from the special counsel? The American people deserve to hear the full, unvarnished truth about Special Counsel Smith's years-long effort to investigate and prosecute the crimes committed by Donald Trump and his co-conspirators." Also today, Senators Ben Ray Lujan, a Democrat of New Mexico, Jeffrey Merkley, a Democrat of Oregon, and Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, along with Representatives Ro Khanna, a Democrat of California, and Thomas Massie, a Republican of Kentucky, wrote a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi asking for a briefing no later than Friday on what she has claimed is new material in the Epstein files that she said on November 14th had caused her to initiate investigations into connections between Jeffrey Epstein and former President Bill Clinton, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, and investor Reid Hoffman. On July 7th, an FBI memo said there was no new evidence to open new investigations against uncharged third parties. Now, the bipartisan lead sponsors of the Epstein Files Transparency Act from both chambers of Congress are calling out what looks to be Bondi's attempt to shield Trump, first by saying that there was no information in the files that would warrant an investigation of uncharged third parties, and then by opening such investigations on Democrats to muddy the waters and possibly claim that she could not release the files because of ongoing investigations. The lawmakers noted they are particularly focused on understanding the contents of any new evidence, information, or procedural hurdles that could interfere with the department's ability to meet the statutory deadline of December 19th and express their interest in making sure the law is fully implemented.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. A new United Nations report accuses Israel of having a de facto state policy of torture for Palestinian hostages. The UN Committee Against Torture states use of torture by the Israeli state was organized and widespread, and it had greatly increased since the beginning of the war on Gaza, starting on the 7th of October, 2023. The United Nations report noted that Israel had no legislation criminalizing torture. It said Israeli state legislation allowed public officials to be exempted from criminal culpability under the so-called principle of necessity. The report comes as Israel faces widespread condemnation over a video showing Israeli border police shooting dead two unarmed men in the occupied West Bank last week. Video recorded the two Palestinian men emerging from a building with their arms raised and their shirts lifted. This is clearly indicating they were unarmed and posed no threat to the Israelis. The United Nations said that the killing in the occupied West Bank appeared to be a summary execution. Summary execution is a war crime under the Geneva Convention and international law. Israeli military, police, and illegal settlers continue to murder Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank in escalating violence.
In a historic judgment, Kenya's High Court on November 27th declared the Seed and Plant Varieties Act unconstitutional. This gives a significant victory for smallholder Kenyan farmers and advocates of food sovereignty across the country of Kenya. The case was filed by 15 smallholder farmers from various regions of Kenya. It challenged provisions in the law that criminalize the long-standing tradition of saving, sharing, and exchanging indigenous seeds. Seed-saving practices have been at the heart of Kenyan agriculture for generations. Under the law, Kenyan farmers would risk a fine of up to $7,700 or 2 years in prison for participating with informal seed exchanges. The legislation effectively restricted Kenyan farmers to commercial seed markets and increased the farmers' vulnerability to corporate seed control. The decision is a relief for Kenyan farmers, and it is expected to have an impact for food sovereignty and agricultural sustainability in the country of Kenya. Smallholder farmers account for over 70% of agricultural production in Kenya. These farmers often rely on farmer-saved seeds that are adapted to local climates and conditions. By affirming their right to maintain and exchange these seeds, the Kenyan High Court has reinforced the role of Kenyan farmers as custodians of biodiversity and protectors of sustainable agricultural practices. The African Union has called for historical crimes, including slavery, colonialism, and racial segregation, to be formally recognized and criminalized as Africa intensifies its campaign for global reparations. Leaders from across Africa met in Algeria to advance a resolution adopted by the African Union earlier this year. African Union has designated 2025 as the year of reparations. Algerian Foreign Minister Ahmed Attaf cited Algeria's experience under French colonial rule to press for colonialism to be treated as an international crime and to strengthen Africa's demands for accountability. Algeria's minister said France had sought to make Algeria a different country by replacing Algeria's people, identity, institutions, culture, religion, and even its language. Algerian Minister Attaf stated that Africa is entitled to demand the official and explicit recognition of the crimes committed against its peoples during the colonial period. He noted African countries continue to pay a heavy price in terms of exclusion, marginalization, and underdevelopment. For decades, African and Caribbean governments and activists have pushed for compensation and other forms of redress for slavery and colonial rule by Western powers. Some former Western colonial powers have taken very limited steps towards acknowledgement of these crimes. Germany has recognized its genocide against Namibia. Belgium has apologized for atrocities in the Congo. And France has admitted responsibility for certain massacres in Algeria. And in the final story, Venezuelan Presidente Nicolas Maduro says that Venezuela will not bow down to the United States military or political coercion. On Monday, Presidente Maduro said Venezuela sought peace, but only a peace with sovereignty, equality, and freedom. Mr. Maduro condemned Washington's aggression, stating, "We do not want a slave's peace or the peace of colonies." The U.S. government has escalated pressure on Venezuela through a military buildup in the Caribbean, describing the military threats as an anti-drug trafficking mission without any evidence. Venezuela says the aggressive and illegal measures taken by U.S. President Trump and his administration are designed to overthrow Mr. Maduro's government. This so the United States can seize control of Venezuela's extremely extensive natural resources, including oil. Analysts say the scale of U.S. military activity far exceeds anything that would be required for a so-called anti-drug operation. Mr. Trump has deployed 15,000 troops, aircraft carriers, submarines, destroyers, and F-35 jet squadrons in the Caribbean region. The U.S. has also carried out at least 21 extrajudicial executions on so-called alleged drug vessels in the Caribbean and Pacific since September, murdering at least 83 people. The Trump administration is guilty of these war crimes under domestic and international law, with no action by the United States Congress to stop it. And despite the bizarre pressure from Mr. Trump's administration, several international airlines are maintaining their air routes to Venezuela. This action is defying a so-called United States air blockade, disguised as a security measure by Mr. Trump. Panamanian, Colombian, and Bolivian-based air carriers have maintained flights in and out of Venezuela. Colombian President Gustavo Petro referred to Mr. Trump's warnings about flights to Venezuela, stating, "The United States does not have the right to close Venezuelan airspace. It can do so with its own airlines, but not with the airlines of the world." That's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.